So on today's episode of The Statistical Life, we'll be talking about the book How to Lie with Statistics, which is a riveting read about how people use statistics to back up their own interests, and sometimes they use these statistics in a misleading way. So the intro talks a lot about how a lot of times people's realities are disconnected with what statistics actually say, and about how a lot of this is fueled by the media. They gave the example about how newspapers report on crime a lot, so it could give the illusions that there is a lot of crime. But just because a newspaper is reporting on a lot of crime doesn't necessarily mean that there's more crime. Another example was that I thought of relating to that was like with global warming. So whenever news shows talk about global warming, they'll bring on one person who is like says global warming exists and one person who says global warming doesn't exist. This warps public perception because it gives them the idea that this is something to be debated, when in fact 99% of scientists do agree that global warming is something exists. But when you're giving equal time to both arguments, you're creating the illusion that this is something that is actually up for discussion when it is really a proven scientific fact. But going on to chapter one. So chapter one is about this, is called The Sample with the Built-in Bias, and it's about like sample sizes, sample demographics, and how that can create a bias. The first example they brought up was about Yale University. In the 1930s, Time Magazine reported that the average Yale graduate makes about $25,000 a year, which is, you know, an impressive statistic, I think, at the time. It was for the class of 1924. But what the book goes on to talk about was how, well, yeah, $25,000 for the people who answered the survey. And the way the survey was done is it was mailed out. So if someone's address wasn't up to date in the mailing list, their salary was not considered. And then what the book also points out is that those whose addresses were out of date are more likely to be moving around a lot, means they're more likely to be financially unstable. For example, there's the sort of stereotype of the starving artist who's sort of living on couch to couch. Their salary would not be counted because they wouldn't have their address up to date. However, those who are rich and those who are public figures are more likely to be counted in the survey because they're more easily to contact, because they're in the public eye. What this also made me think about was I read a statistic about how UPenn has the highest amount of graduates who go on to become millionaires. And people sort of use that as evidence of UPenn being like one of the best schools. But I also know that UPenn has one of the richest student bodies. So what I think would have been a more interesting statistic to reflect like how well a college is at preparing students to enter the workforce is what college has the highest rate of upward mobility. That is, what college has the highest percentage of students who are making more than their families did when they were being raised? Another thing they talked about was like with studies that are conducted by interviews, a lot of times something like race and gender can come into play, especially if the interviewer is in a societal position of power over the interviewee. This book is a little outdated, and they use the term Negro quite liberally, but basically they were saying like if a white man were to interview a black man and he were to ask him questions about like patriotism, it's less likely that the black man would say something that would be perceived as not being patriotic, because that they didn't want to upset the white man or cause violence to happen against them. So now I'm just going to open it up to Tian and Jasir to see if they have any comments about this. And I think, Jasir, do you have a comment? All right.
Okay, so something that I found really interesting for the first chapter was when they were talking about the surveys and how surveys, the way they give statistics, are not based on a large body of people. They were saying like if like maybe 5% of the people will actually answer the survey, and that's actually considered to be a really, really good amount. But if you really think about like if 5 people out of 100, you know, 5 people are representing, like their statistics are representing that whole 100, and it just shows you how statistics can really make you make the person they're trying to sell the information to perceive something that is not necessarily true. There was something in the beginning that I really liked as well. Hold on, where is it? Hmm. you have anything, Tiana, to say while I look for this?
So one of the main things that I found interesting in the first chapter was the fact that when they were talking about these sample sizes, another thing they talked about was like the selection of the interviewers when they do these things is very is a very crucial thing. And some of these like interviewers are chosen for specific reasons because they can pander to a certain demographic. That way the interview can get the answers that they want or things that they need. Another thing that I found like really interesting was, like Ruby said earlier, like the like very liberal use of the word Negro. I'm not sure specifically when the book was written, but it's just kind of interesting to see that even the term was used so loosely back then. Jesse, did you find anything?
1954
is when the book was written.
So I guess concluding the first chapter, it's really interesting that the statistics, like the way statistics are advertised and given out and this certain amount of data, hasn't really changed much if we're saying 1954. And the same techniques and pretty much the same thing is being sold to us over and over, and they're still doing the same thing. I guess now it's like maybe a bit more extreme and more intense for the population today just because of the rise in social media and technology. But overall, it seems like the same techniques are being used, and there's always going to be a built-in bias when statistics are given out.
So we're going to hear a little bit more from Jasir about Chapter 2, which is about averages and how they are chosen.
Okay, so Chapter 2 is called The Well-Chosen Average, and we learned this in class. When did we learn this? Earlier in the year, and pretty much talked about how average is such a loose word, and that's pretty much how the book opens up. It tells you that average can be used in so many different ways because there are so many different types of averages. So the book opens up talking about a landlord or someone selling a property, and the agent tells the person who's trying to buy the property that the average income in this neighborhood is $15,000, which is, you know, pretty decent back then. It's probably a well upper middle class lifestyle back then. So the person assumes that the $15,000 neighborhood is going to be a nice neighborhood. It's going to have nice property, and they emphasize that he's a snob. So I guess to say that he's stuck up, he's not really going to do his own research. You know, he feels like he has the money, he doesn't really care. Mm-hmm. So I guess, you know, emphasizing that he buys the house not really caring. You know, he's a snob. They emphasize that pretty. They emphasize that a lot. So then it says, you know, eventually after he buys the house, later on, the person who sold him the house, who's trying to keep the tax assessments down, or tax rate down, that's the word they use, he says that they're trying to keep it down because the average income in the neighborhood is only $3,500. Now, earlier he said that the average was 15, and now he's saying that the average is $3,500. And in no way is he lying legally about that statistic, because he used two different types of averages, where it doesn't say exactly what average he used in the book, but what it does tell you that, you know, he could have used the average income for maybe the average of each person, where they added the incomes and divided it by the number of people they surveyed, where also they could have used the range, they could have used the median, they could have used so many different types of things, which would have gave you a vast ranges of different statistics. What I think is really interesting, because I know that this can happen in Philadelphia, where there are some neighborhoods where, you know, if you look at the average income of that neighborhood, it may seem really poor or really great, because there are some neighborhoods that are literally divided by streets, where there's a rich side and a poor side. And there are some neighborhoods where there's literally a property that's like worth $200,000 in like a $50,000 neighborhood, where there's just like a giant, you know, where there's people who are buying properties, fixing them up, and, you know, I guess in forms, you know, gentrification, and where they're just buying these large properties, and it's kind of like forcing the neighborhood in a different direction. And I think that I've seen that happen in many different cities in America. So, does anyone else want to say anything?
Well, I think it's really interesting about how this article or this chapter sort of like talks about how the real estate agent is like framing whether or not one would want to live in the neighborhood by the income. So he says that the average income for this neighborhood is $15,000 a year, which in 2000, this is published in 1954, so we just looked it up, and in 2015, that would be $130,000 and $885.87. That was a very strange way to say that number. But it's like an upper-middle-class neighborhood. So I guess like if one was upper-middle-class and wanted to self-segregate, then that's where they would go. I also think it was interesting just sort of taking the like American cultural context into account is that the 1950s, when this was published, was sort of like the golden age of American consumerism. And like there is a vast number of like consumer products available on the market for the first time. And like this is really when we start to see like the concept of the American dream being defined as like very specific, like living in a suburban house with a white picket fence, you know, and a two-car garage. And so like this is when Americans are really defining themselves by material wealth. And I just think it's interesting that this book is bringing that into light and highlighting that. Probably not intentionally. Well, definitely not intentionally, because that's just how people are. But I just think it's a very interesting thing to think about, especially when relating to statistics.
One thing that I found interesting with this part of the book specifically was just that there are so many different types of averages. And I'm like, just for me, it was a little bit eye-opening, the fact that they don't necessarily lie when they use these different averages, but they're just so widely like known, as Jasir discussed earlier. And the fact that like they in like some of these different kinds of scenarios, like they'll use statistics that aren't really needed. So for example, in a like a car campaign or something like that, they might use the mean of something and call that the average. And in no way are they lying, but they aren't telling you specifically what you need to know or what you would prefer to know.
Okay. And another thing that I found really interesting that I wanted to talk about is the way they talk about average income. And I can't remember who brought it up. Maybe it was you, Mr. Miles, but either way. It was when they were talking about income of a business, and they gave an example, I think it was in a worksheet, where it was like, the average income was, I'm just going to make this number up for the purpose of the point, was $50,000. And, you know, that's pretty decent, you know, it's not, well, it's pretty decent. It's like, you know, lower middle class, really, middle class. And, but anyway, what they didn't show was like how that people were, like the average person really, like the number that you would really want to know if you were taking a job, the average person was really getting paid around $20,000, and the person who was really like distorting the number was the owner and like the management, who were getting paid like hundreds of thousand dollars, like $1 million. So that shows just like how crazy just a few numbers can really divert the statistic, and how technically they didn't lie to you. That is the average income. But now we're going to move on to chapter 3, which is the little figures that are not there, and Tian will be talking about.
So in chapter 3, which is called The Little Figures that are Not There, this chapter overall, it really just discusses how different ad campaigns and different marketing like uses statistics and the way that they warp them. The first thing they talk about specifically that I found interesting was like how the sample sizes are really small. As Ruby discussed earlier, sample sizes for ad campaigns are usually made to fit whatever is needed. For a specific test, or just like given, just they'll make a sample size specifically made for whatever is needed for their need. They also, when they talked about the probability of some of these things and how ads are using them, it's like one of the things they talked about earlier was if you're tossing a penny about 10 times, you expect it to be 50-50, but in reality, it'll get closer to 50-50 the more that you flip it, but it'll start off one way. It'll start off going towards one direction specifically. The chapter just overall, it just talks about how like some of these really irrational statistics that if they were put into full sample size and they were put out evenly, ads wouldn't be as enticing just because of the fact that they are so warped now. Anybody have any comments on that?
Yeah, I see a lot of statistics manipulated by companies. I was listening to this really interesting piece on NPR about pharmaceutical companies and how they will go every day at lunch to hospitals and like buy the doctor's steak dinner and like give them free samples of their prescription drugs and like encourage them to prescribe them to people who don't even need it. And like when a doctor prescribes a drug that to a patient, like the pharmaceutical company will count it as an endorsement, but like really, and they'll say stuff like 3 out of 4 doctors like endorse this product. But like in reality, they don't really, the doctors, like sure, maybe verbally they endorse it, but they haven't really done their due diligence in endorsing the product. And so like when companies use these statistics like that, they're manipulating doctors to push this product on consumers. And then in the commercials, they're manipulating consumers, leading them to believe that the doctors that they manipulated to say this product was good is actually good. So there's just like a lot of manipulation going on, and a lot of this is done through statistics. And I think it's so interesting how even though this book was written 51 years ago, a lot of it is, or no, not 51 years, 61 years ago, a lot of this information is still very relevant.
So I guess to piggyback off the point Ruby made, when it was like 3 out of 4 doctors may endorse this product, which is really interesting that they may not tell you that these doctors may be hired by the company, and these doctors are employed by the company, and these it literally may be 4 doctors, so literally 3 out of 4 doctors. And anyway, you know, you can really lie. Like, there are the, especially with advertising, there are the limits and grounds of which you're needed to tell the truth are very lenient, and like you can really say anything that you want, and you can pretty much say it's freedom of speech, really. So it's really hard to trust statistics, and I think for the common person, it's really hard to. I mean, it's for the common person, it's really hard for them to get the information they really need, because at the end of the day, it's really all about profits. And I'm looking just at the pictures, and a lot of them really just have to do with money. You know, there's a lot of graphs, there are a lot of things just about projecting, you know, how can we sell the message to get this person to buy what we want them, or to buy my product.
So. Yeah, you know, as they say, cream, cash rules everything around me. And I just, you know, I think a lot of times it's, like Jasir was saying, it's definitely hard for people to know what to believe. And I generally think, like, going into things, like, neutral and not going in, like, with any assumptions is the best thing to do. But obviously we all go in with our own biases and assumptions. And, like, something that bothers me a lot is when I see people, like, sharing articles on Facebook from super unreliable sources, like, one source that people who are super into like pseudoscience and anti-vaccinations, like one website people share from a lot is called like Spirit Science and Metaphysics. Have you guys ever seen that website? I really hate that website. It's full of so much misinformation. A certain SLA alum shared an article from there saying that Ebola was created by the U.S. government, and the evidence of that was that one man no one was actually getting Ebola. It was made up by the U.S. government, and their evidence was that one guy in Africa said that it was made up, and she decided that made more sense than the fact that literally hundreds of thousands of people are dying from it. So yeah, I think a lot of times people will selectively believe certain information and not others to make it fit into their own narrative. And I think for me, as someone who's like very concerned about social justice and fairness, is I think it's very important to understand that not everything fits neatly into one box, and that there are nuances to every situation, and that it's important to like be rational and to consider facts before like moving forward and making like broad brushstroke reform. So, does anyone else have anything to say? So, thanks for tuning in to This Statistical Life. This is our first episode. Next episode, we'll be talking about some really interesting stuff with statistics. So, Can't wait to talk to you.
So in this recording, we're going to be explaining questions 1, 2, 3, and 4 that were posed to us. The first one, the quotation I chose to explain was, there are three kinds of lies: lies, damn lies, and statistics. Now, in the intro of the book, it talks about, it opens with how the author's father told him that there's a higher crime rate in California than there was in Iowa, which he sort of believes as true in the beginning, but as he looks through, as he gets older and looks through his own statistical lens of things, he sees that that's not always particularly true, specifically with murders, just because it's just projected that way. And it's not particularly a lie per se, it's more of a cover up to make the to make a place look safer than it is. What the quotation honestly means is that statistics can be a form of not lying, but not always telling the complete and honest truth and manipulating the data to the way that you want it to look. And that's most of what the book, that's mostly basically what the book covers, is about how like statistics are used to manipulate how people think about things, how people see things and perceive them in different ways. Just like this is mostly done with usually like studies about, you know, maybe a new type of drug working better than another one, when in reality, because the sample size was so small, it looks like it works better, but it actually doesn't. The second question was about on on page 18, which reads about how a river can't rise above its source, but that's only true if the pumping station is concealed. It seems true if the pumping station is concealed. This is, again, another thing that's partially true, but not always. Basically, what the analogy is saying is that a river itself can't get bigger or rise over the source of water that it's coming from, but when it's been put through filters and all these other things that people have to do with irrigation, it can end up rising above its source in some situations. And that's the same thing with statistics. Statistics can't lie per se, because they're numbers, and numbers really can't lie. Once you get numbers are partially facts, so you can't lie with that, but you can manipulate it to make it seem that it looks better for you in any given situation, which is, again, like I explained before, what most companies do when they're trying to advertise a new product or if they're trying to get anything to work in their favor particularly. And that's mostly what that means. It basically means that you can manipulate statistics to help you in any sort, in any way that you see fit. Now I'm going to let Jasir explain questions 3 and 4.
Okay, so question 3 was, what is the advantage of stratified random sample and what difficulties does it pose according to this chapter? So at first I was really, I didn't even understand what stratified sampling was. But rereading and like doing some further research, I guess from what I understand about stratified sampling is that it samples smaller and more specific groups of people within a population. So I guess the difficulties that it may pose is that, one, I mean, you have to do more effort. You need to find the group of people and within the subgroup of people within the larger population and gather that data, which is a lot difficult, especially if you're trying to figure out things past, you know, just gender or something, but actual like personal traits or whatever. And then the second thing is that because you're getting this data from subgroups, your data like in total isn't going to be as large, meaning that your data can be skewed a little bit because the total isn't as big as it would be if you were doing a regular sample of the whole population. Number 4 is, what does the author mean on page 45 when he says hardly anybody is exactly normal in any way? From what I got from that quote is, before the quote was referring to, like, I think a child, a parent, a child, like, at a doctor. Hold on, let me make sure I get this right. A Okay, so yeah, the quote, the sentence before that was parents seeing that their youngsters fall within the normal range will quit worrying about small meaningless differences. And I think that especially now with like technology, just normal, and I guess saying people, that people are normal, no person is exactly the same. Even twins, you know, they're still different in some sort of way. And I guess normal referring to the medical field or actually even referring to people is really saying, do you fall within the range or do you carry the characteristics that allow you to fit in and fit into society? And so like normal is like, I guess, you know, if your child comes out with like all four limbs and, you know, his head on right and, you know, no signs of mental illness or whatever. And then it's like kind of saying like, okay, he's normal per se in the terms of not necessarily that a person without those things is malnormal, but like that, what is the word I'm looking for, Tian? Not abnormal, I'm just saying like, it's when he, I guess when he was referring to hardly as anybody's normal, because nobody's the same. And so to say that something is normal, which is usually referring to how people are the same and referring that like the least differences between people, is kind of skewed. So no one can technically be normal because there is no definition of what a normal person is.
On today's episode of The Statistical Life, we'll be hearing from me, Jasir, and Tian about many super fun topics about statistics. First, we're going to hear from Jasir, who's going to talk about manipulating people's thoughts with numbers. All right, Jasir, it's all you.
Okay, I'll be talking about chapter 4, which is Much Ado About Practically Nothing. In opening this chapter, the author talks about the way IQ tests are measured and looked upon. So he tells us a story about these two kids named Peter and Linda, and Peter ends up with an IQ score of 98 and Linda with 101. Now, the parents may think, okay, Linda's the smarter child, but what he makes sure that he highlights in this chapter is that when you think of IQ, you think about how it measures intelligence, but it doesn't necessarily do that because it fails to factor in creativity and artistic skills and creative arts and leadership, so many other things that would factor into intelligence and making good decisions. He also later talked about... what is this here? It is called standard error, probable error, and the way that probable error can be factored in because not these tests are not necessarily accurate. So he said, so if the probable error of, you know, the calculated probable error was 3, so Peter's IQ was 98 plus or minus 3, and then Linda's was plus or was 101 plus or minus 3. If Linda's, you know, IQ was ended up being minus 3 and Peter's was plus 3, it actually showed that Peter was actually more intelligent than Linda and actually got a higher IQ score. So, would you guys like to touch up on this?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of times, especially when it comes to standardized tests like IQ tests, but also the Keystones, is that people think that they can measure how much someone knows, but like they don't test for everything. So, you know, on the IQ test, like Jasir was saying, someone could know a lot about math and science, but like if they can't explain it to other people or break it down in a way that other people can understand, then like is the intelligence really useful? And so like if someone isn't emotionally intelligent, if they can't apply like their just traditional academic intelligence, then like how useful really is that? So Tia?
I found this chapter interesting concerning the fact that it only really talked about psychological tests. Like myself being a psychology major, I found this very compelling just off the fact that people use these psychological tests to, you know, measure people's intelligence, or in other cases, they may use it to group people into certain areas for, you know, some studies or things like that. But in reality, as Ruby and Jasir both said, that it doesn't really measure that. I don't think a test can measure someone's personality that well, which is one of the conflicting things I'm having about going in with my major specifically. But I don't know. I like how this chapter just basically explains that even using the two cases with the two kids about how their IQs may be different, but they may be telling two completely different stories. I just found very interesting. So it's next. Oh, okay.
Lastly, one thing that he talked about with probable error is when taking these tests, it's really about being a good reader. And if your reading skills aren't necessarily great and you can't read fast and process information, you know, on the spot within seconds, then you won't do well in these tests, regardless of how much knowledge you actually know about the subject. And I think I can really relate to this because I know, like, for the SATs, like, I did really well in the beginning, but, like, eventually, like, my brain got tired and my reading skills kind of just fell off from the just naturally just looking at so much in black and white at one time for so many hours. But I know that, like, my SAT score was lower than people whose grades aren't as good as mine, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're smarter than I am or that I'm even smarter than them. It's just really about how these tests and are structured. So these tests really don't measure much.
So next we're going to talk about my chapter five, which was called the G-Wiz graph. And it's a very short chapter, and it's basically just about how people can manipulate the way they draw graphs to, like, make something seem like it isn't. So one of the main thing they talked about was, like, making the increments on the axes smaller, particularly if you make the increments, like, closer together on a y-axis, it makes it look like the slope is steeper, which could suggest a trend. Like, if you're doing something, for example, if you're graphing something and your y-axis increments are by 10, then the slope is going to be a lot steeper than if your increments are by 100, and the same is for vice versa. And so this comes into play when, for example, they showed two graphs here about government payrolls. One of them, the increments were smaller, and one of them were larger. And if you look at the one with the larger increments, it looks like government payrolls are, like, plateauing, like they're just straight. But if you look at the graph with the closer together increments, it looks like the slope is steeper, and it looks like the government payrolls are, like, up a lot more than they actually are, when in reality it's, like, barely $500. So yeah, here you know, it's a pretty short and sweet chapter. Jasir, Tian, comments?
I think that when reading this chapter, it can be connected to politics and the graphs they really show in the news and, like, media and the way they want you to see certain things. So when they talk about epidemics in this country, like, which we have every year, there's, like, a new flu outbreak every year, which is, like, just pretty much the race hysteria. And they show these graphs of, like, look how many people are getting it, but then you actually do your own research and it's like, this isn't that many people. And it's like, well, it's really only in this area. And then it just goes so much deeper. And it's like the way you can make a graph really look like anything if you know how to properly scale it right, and depending on, like, how much information you actually wanted to display.
I said for this chapter that it truly is, like, what the title of the book and how people lie with statistics is because when usually people really don't want to get into the nitty-gritty of, like, numbers and, like, this means this and this means this. So having the ability to scale things the way you want them to be, especially with today's technology, is extremely, extremely easy for, you know, companies and organizations, just because they can now have their surveys and have their findings, what they want them to be specifically, or what they want things to be, and how they want people to see exactly their data. So next we're going to be talking about chapter 6, which is called The One-Dimensional Picture. And this chapter is sort of a continuation of the previous one, where it talks about how people use and how people manipulate graphs to make their information more interesting. What this one talks about in the beginning specifically is a pictorial graph, which is sort of the graphs you used to see in middle school, where they'll show pictures exactly of what you're measuring, where it'll be, you know, what's one ball equals 100 balls in this case. It sort of it sort of plays with people psychologically in the sense that you're seeing one thing and it's kind of messing with your head, I guess. It's just really about different tricks and how people use them specifically in other things. One example they use is there's a picture of two money bags. One is smaller than the other, just because of the sheer volume. What they say is you are obviously gonna want to go towards the bigger money bag. However, you don't know the contents of what's inside the bag. Just because it seems bigger, and it may have a larger volume, you assume that there's more in there. While the smaller bag may have more valuables in it, but because it's smaller, you won't want to go towards it. These are just really small and simple tricks about how people use them, about how people like just easily lie with statistics. So open up the floor to Ruby.
Yeah, this book was written like a really long time ago in the 50s, I think. And it's interesting to think about how visual data has changed with the internet. Like, I see infographics all the time, which are like really long visual displays of data that, and like they get a lot of, you know, shares on social media. But a lot of times I'll see that these infographics are doing like what they did in my chapter, which is like having really weird axes, or like what Tion talked about is like having really confusing like data pictures where you're not really sure what it means. So like something I'm always careful about before I share something on the internet is that I make sure it like comes from a reliable source and the data is good and like not misleading, because I think that's really important. Like, I think it's important that we're making decisions or like forming opinions around good data rather than like bad or misleading data.
Okay, so another thing, I guess lastly that I wanted to talk about was the way, or it's kind of what Tion touched on, was about the way they just make a picture bigger than the last picture, and it just gives you a more lasting impression on, like, you know, the increase. So, for example, they have this cow, and they talk about, like, there were 8 million cows in 1860 in this area, and they have, like, a picture of a small cow, and then in 1936, it went to 25 million cows, and they just drew a bigger picture, and you can kind of get that effect by just looking at the picture. So, yeah.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Statistical Life. We'll have some more like really interesting stuff for you next week. Have a great life.
So the people here today for this recording are myself, Tion, and Jasir, and we're going to go over chapters 7 and 8 of How to Lie with Statistics. So in chapter 7 is called The Semi-Attached Figure, and basically what the chapter goes over is the fact that statistics are numbers that are proven. Like, these are things that you can't make up, you can't change the numbers, but people find ways to manipulate and make it look as good as it can. But this chapter is specifically about when a company or something like that can't prove what they want to specifically, so they'll use another, like, something that they think is similar to what they wanted to prove in order to prove their point. One example that the book used was if a company says that their new drug cures all fevers or cures all headaches or things of that nature, but they can't prove that it actually does kill, like that it stops colds or that it stops whatever that it's supposed to stop. They can prove that it kills X amount of germs. So you can say that our product, it kills 35% of all germs found in your nostrils when you have a fever. This is one of the things that companies use to try to make themselves seem better when they can't actually prove exactly what they wanted to and like their full point. Another example of this that the chapter talked about is how companies use it to not tell their, like, they'll conceal their full profit over, like, through a fiscal year. Like, they'll try to differentiate like different parts of their profit. So maybe a company will say, like, we made certain amount of money, we made X amount of money off of these deals, but they'll only show what exactly needs to be shown to, you know, the government, other people, economics professors, instead of showing the full numbers, which usually end up being a little bit more corrupt than they need to be sometimes. But that's mainly what this chapter was about. There weren't any like big things other than the fact that it just told me about how different these things are. But now I'm gonna let Jasir talk a little bit about chapter 8.
Okay. So what this chapter made me think about, like, that I see a lot because I watch a lot of sports. So a lot of news, like sports anchors, will make up statistics when comparing players to make it seem relevant. So they'll say something like really outlandish, such as like LeBron has scored the most points within the first 30 seconds of the second quarter past the 6-minute mark. And it's like, then they'll compare him with like Michael Jordan or other great basketball players, when it's like, what does that really mean? And it's just like, the whole point is kind of to add value to something that really doesn't have much of it or doesn't have the same relevancy. You want to say anything else to me?
I felt like when reading over chapter 8, like, it tells you a little bit more about not how people try to lie with statistics, but how they try to make themselves look better with statistics. Like Jasir said, with basketball and football stats specifically, it tries to warp people's minds a little bit, and I found that a lot more interesting. Like, there's nothing that I can really disagree with in that chapter specifically, or anything that Jasir said, just because it does make sense. And I found myself actually like falling into some of these things, especially with like stats, because when you start arguing with people about like, you know, this basketball player or this football player or this person is better than this, you compare stats, you can say things like, well, his playoff percentage is better here, 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 and here, but in reality it's not. Like, it's the same thing that happened specifically recently with the Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao boxing match. A lot of people thought that Floyd didn't really like fight as much as he should have. Like, he threw a certain number of punches, but a lot of people called it that he was hugging the entire fight, but in reality the statistics show that he did land more punches that he threw. But if you actually watch the fight, you can see that they were all calculated, and it makes it seem that if you weren't watching the fight, it makes it seem that Floyd did a lot better than what the stats make it look like, I guess.
Yeah, I think I watched the match too, and I just thought, I don't know, for me, people didn't really like the fight, but then I guess for me, like, as a person who just enjoys boxing, to me it was more than a fight. Like, yeah, if you were looking to just see people get beat up, it was terrible, but if you're looking at a good boxing match, it was, to me, I thought it was pretty great. And I think that, like, the statistics show, like, people thought that Manny was really aggressive, but, like, he only landed, I think, like, 17% of his punches or something like that. And it's just, I don't know, it just shows, like, how, like, pretty much people, when especially with boxing and especially with those two characters, they'll say whatever they want to warp your mind, to, especially if you didn't watch the fight, they'll make you think anything because they can really pull out any stat. So you just have to be careful. So on to chapter 8. Okay, so chapter 8 was called Post Hoc Rides Again. And pretty much what I got from this chapter was pretty much like a quote that I pulled out that I thought defined the whole chapter pretty much, was that you can make any two characteristics seem correlated, you throw away the results you don't want, and you publish widely what you do. And that's like, I think that's just almost like a natural human trait, and something that is like also really like designed professionally, like further than just naturally doing it. And one thing that they say, you know, like, so if you're doing a study and, you know, there's some negative effects or something, like, you can just throw that out. It's like, technically, you're not lying by saying, yes, it does cure X disease, but, you know, in reality, it also may cause something else. And I don't know, you just see that a lot. Like, where do you see that, Tiana?
I see it mostly in, like, in, you know, study, in these quote-unquote, like, really extensive studies where you, as a person, like, if you are into like the thing that they're talking about, it's easy to tell that not all of the data is true. Like one thing that I found was, like, when they talk about musicians and, like, the amount of them that go deaf, and they're saying that, oh, well, musicians go deaf because they're around such loud equipment all the time and this, that, and third. But in reality, while, yes, that does play a very large factor, they don't factor in the fact that, you know, that they have to practice these things on their own, that they're around other things, because usually with musicians, they don't particularly just have the music job. Like, some of them actually work in, like, heavy machinery, where they have to wear earmuffs to make sure that they don't go deaf or anything like that. So when I saw one of the studies that said, like, 80% of all, like, touring musicians go deaf, I found it really, like, odd, because that wasn't completely true. But again, this is more about just making yourself seem better than what your data actually shows.
Yeah, I think this is, like, probably the number one marketing scheme in a way. You know, like, I don't think you can find a commercial that ever shows the full side, or that hasn't really done this. Because, of course, you know, if you're selling a product, you're not going to tell them what's bad about it, because you're trying to sell the thing. The second part was the conclusion, which they were talking about towards the end of the chapter. And they were pretty much saying that you can pretty much make, or they'll say a conclusion after they, you know, relate two facts or two interesting things that may not necessarily be the cause of another.
Mama, me too.
Hello. So we're going to be talking about chapter 9 and 10, and here today is Jasir and Tian. So in chapter 9, writing the name of this, how to statisticulate, it was pretty much falling in line with the rest of the book and just saying, like, how statisticians. Anyway, use graphs and stuff. They don't say manipulate, but they like to use the word statisticulate to change your opinion, or I guess lead you to believe a certain thing, even though that may not necessarily be true. So they talked about, like, the mean of an income and then the median of the income, and just talking about, like, that of America, and just saying, like, how that can lead you to different whole things. I think in general, I think this chapter really sums up, like, all the chapters in the book. So it was pretty much, you know, saying, like, how can I make you see something? Like, you can show two different things and show two different people, and, like, just, like, changing something small, like, just saying, I did the average, but, like, what average should you use? It can leave the people with two different perceptions.
Yeah, when I read over this chapter, like, it basically went over some familiar territory when it was talking about how graphs are, like, manipulated in different types of ways, and, well, they just basically gave it a name now, statisticulation. But to me, the thing I got most out of this chapter was how, like, companies and, you know, people who use these things are basically saying, not what do you, like, what, they're basically showing them what they want them to see. Instead of showing them the full results, it's basically trying to say, well, what I want you to see, what makes me look the best in this situation. And I feel like this chapter has been, like, pretty much just a summary of how, like, you know, how numbers can be manipulated, and how, like, you can use the data just to come to your effect specifically. So for chapter 10, it's called How to Talk Back to Statistics. It's basically, the chapter just goes over basically how to not get scammed and how to not get fooled with these things. And it says, it talks about, like, you have to ask yourself five simple questions, like, who says these, like, what kind of source is it coming from? Is it coming from a credible source or anything like that? And, like, depending on who this information is coming from, it's more likely that you'll get better information from, you know, a trusted source, which would be maybe your doctor, for example, versus something that you see on TV or from a company, because they're a very big range of how people react to these things. Another thing was how do people respond to it honestly? Like, if you were to come, if you were to ask a person themselves, instead of not looking at the numbers, if you were to ask just a random person how they respond to whatever the question may be, like, do you like this soda more, or is this a better shampoo? If getting like real honest answers from people rather than cut off sections is another thing that helps with the reliability of when you get these things. And the really big thing that I liked when I read over this chapter was it said that, does it make sense and did somebody change the subject? Because the entire book has been talking about how people manipulate the numbers and basically how they change it to look like what they want it to look like, which is in a sense changing the subject of what you're overall examining. It's not fully changing everything, but it's changing what you need to, like, what you want to see, what they want you to see. Overall, like, it's saying, like, does it make sense that even with these changes, do these numbers still make sense? So you have anything to say about that, Justin?
To piggyback off what you were just saying, I think it's just, like, I think the underlining word I got from this chapter, which is, like, credibility. And I guess one of the things they tried to highlight on page 127 was what's missing. And I think that's, like, the hardest thing when you're, I guess, debating with someone who's trying to give you statistics, is that it's hard to find that. Like, you, every time you see a graph, you're not going to have the time to literally do the research and find out what's missing. And it's all about credibility. So who can we really believe? And I think that's the interesting part, because, like, definitely not politicians. And that's probably where we get most of our statistical information or stuff that we've seen. And I guess along with them, it's also marketers. And it's just like, they may not be lying, but they're probably not telling you what you think they want you to, like, they're not conveying the real information of the perception that you're probably having about their product. And I think that that's, like, the biggest part, is how do we find out what's missing? Is it possible for us to find out what's missing? And how can we challenge people, I guess, to learn, or to learn about, how can we challenge people to learn more about what they're buying, or when they're consumers, or when they're, I guess, yeah, consumers of just information or even of the product? How can we teach them that, you know, they may not be buying the product of that their perception is painted in their head?
So we hope you enjoyed our full podcast about summarizing the book How to Lie with Statistics by Daryl Huff. Overall, I enjoyed the book, and it did show its age in some of the examples they use and how it was a little dated. But overall, I enjoy about just getting to learn how, like, companies, basically learning how companies think and how using their logic in some situations may help you or may hinder you.
All right, so thank you, and that's our benchmark.